always say it's pushing evolution. I would say we are here to like help our parents evolve in the sense of our thinking, our insight, our, you know, like how the way our mind frame is working.
For many years, thousands of Nepalis have been moving overseas with the hopes of a better education, job, and lifestyle. Some find success in conventional fields, while some carve their own paths. Who is to say one is better than the other? Success is a journey, not a destination. So come on this journey with me, where we connect with our Nepali communities living overseas and explore their conventional and unconventional paths. My name is Sankalpa Gurung, and this is Hamro Yatra. And welcome to Hamro Yatra. For today's episode, we have Millie Adhikari, menstrual health advocate and activist. Based in the US, Millie has a degree in public health and is the director of the North American chapter of Dignified Menstruation. She has also recently received admissions to UC Davis School of Medicine. In this episode, we go over what it means to be a girl in our society, Millie's transition from Nepal to the States, the application process for medical schools, and her drive to become a holistic medical practitioner. She educates us on the power imbalance between menstruators and non-menstruators and how this discrimination has helped shape her passion in the field of reproductive health. Millie is grounded, knows her worth, and emphasizes the importance of being your authentic self. As always, if you enjoy these conversations, please share with your friends and family. Remember to follow our Instagram page at hamro.yatra for updates, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and leave us a 5-star review. You can also financially support us on thisishamroyatra.com/support. Welcome to Hamro Yatra, Millie, and I'm excited to hear about your journey, where you are, and what's next for you.
Thank you so much. I am so appreciative and thankful for this opportunity to speak to you in Hamro Yatra. And I just think that this platform itself is such a good platform to showcase just like the diversity in the Nepali diaspora and in what we're doing. And so the opportunity to share a little bit about the story of Dignified Menstruation and my journey here is wonderful. So I'm really excited too. Thank you.
We usually start with a few icebreakers. Mm-hmm. And the first question being, if you could pick any superpower, what would you pick?
Oh, if I could pick any superpower. I think for me, I would have to pick the ability to speak any language, including sign language. Mm. And I include that as a separate issue just because we don't think normally about sign language. We think about the spoken language, and the way that it is signed is so different than speaking. So I would love to just be able to communicate with any and every single individual in this planet. Mm. I think that would be really an amazing superpower, because when you get to know people's stories and you get to know people's identities and their perspectives and their journeys in the world, it just expands your own perspective so much. And I just think that's one of the most beautiful things of being able to speak to people, you know, just from different walks of life and different corners of the globe. Yeah.
And I think when you do translate stories from different languages, some things are lost because there aren't those exact words that could convey what the storyteller is trying to say either, right? So if you do know how to speak their language, then you get to understand the essence of it all.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's so many like Nepali sayings, right, that translated into English just sounds so crazy or so silly, or they don't come across in the same significance. So
yeah,
I think that'd be a really dope superpower. And then you just go around just speaking to everybody and making connections and colliding energies and like, what else are we doing, right? Like, what else are we doing?
That would be a pretty super cool power. Now, if you could pick one dish for the rest of your life, what would you choose?
Wow. Okay. Now this is the hard one. Oh my God. A dish. Okay. Well, narrowing it down, it would have to be Nepali. I'm really like, I like eat mostly Nepali food, even just here by myself. So Nepali, but I would really miss aloo. Like, I'm just such a big potato fan. Aloo. I'm going to say aloo because I can do anything with that. Like chips chili. I can make like all kinds of variations, like other stuff. Yeah. I'll pick that.
Same. Like with potatoes, I
do not discriminate what kind of dish it is, from mashed potatoes to roast to chips, veggies. I will take everything.
Nom nom for sure. Oh my God.
And Millie, if you could go back into time, specifically into like Nepali historical moment, is there anything that comes to your mind?
Oh, Nepali historical moment. I think as someone who, you know, sort of immigrated due to, you know, like the civil war and due to, you know, quote unquote, people's revolution and all, you know, considering like that's the primary motivator why we moved to the US, I think I would want to, and because I was such a child at the time, right? I was like 9 and 10 years old. So I think I would really love to know and understand a bit more about that historical moment, about that movement itself, just because there's also so much controversy even within Nepal about that movement. And, you know, when I went back in 2018 and living in Jumla, where there was a lot of that, you know, active fire and a lot of the active shootings, you know, and just a lot of movement was there. And so, like, knowing people's stories during that time, it was very eye-opening. And just, you know, as someone who left and then sort of saw the history perspective through maybe like a Western lens, you know, more so than the actual true lens. So I would love to really know about that part. And maybe like just more about like our, you know, our monarchy, and just know more about it from like an adult perspective and understand what was really going on and what was like the primary motivators in that time.
You mentioned that you moved to the States around when you were 9 or 10. Just going back to that, Millie, when you were in Nepal, what was your childhood like? How were you as a child? Yeah. I know you're part of a twin as well, isn't it? Yeah, twin sisters.
Yes, I am. So my name is Millie. Her name is Julie. So Millie Julie.
So cute.
Right. She is, you know, like she's a half of my heart. She's my soul. You know, there's just, you know, I can't begin to express how it feels to be a twin, honestly. And and it's one of the biggest blessings in my life, you know, to know that someone who knows my heart maybe even better than I do, and to have someone in every walk of my life. So having that from the very beginning was wonderful and beautiful, and, you know, has made me who I am, and that I can say with confidence. And, you know, being in Nepal in that time, and even now, it's the same, where, you know, there's a lot of gender selective sexism in general, you know, really pervasive patriarchy and misogyny. And coming from my Baba's family, you know, there's a family of 11 kids. And, you know, big family, you know, from Bhojpur, and we immigrated to Kathmandu. And that's when my parents kind of met. And so being the only two girls for my parents, you know, at that time, and even now, I think that was definitely an experience that we continue to live through now. And, you know, in Nepal as well, you know, just being like, oh, like, bhai chaina, like, you don't have a brother, like, you don't have like an older brother, younger brother. They're like, no brothers. And I'm like,
hey, chori ho, like, you have chori dhan, like,
yeah. Hey, like, bhai khai, that chaina. It's like, nope, chaina, like, bhai ni mata isa. And so it was a good childhood. It's not that, you know, we were privileged in a lot of senses, that, you know, looking at the class distribution, looking at where we lived, you know, we had a house, we had, you know, we had finances for good schooling, for food, for activities, whatever. I think in terms of social norms, you know, again, being like, being a Jurua and being just two girls, there's definitely that, you know, always like, oh, hito, like, you know, that sort of a pity. And it's just so funny when you think about it, because you're just like, wow, like, from childhood, we're trained and were, you know, if you are just girls, then you are told like, oh, you better prove to the world that we don't need boys, you know? And I think that's something that for maybe our parents, it was because, you know, they went against the family norms and the societal norms to just be like, well, no, we're not having any more kids. And I'm so grateful for that. But on the flip side, I always think like, I can't believe I have to be happy that my parents chose to just have two kids, because they just wanted two kids and decided to stop at girls, you know? And the fact that there's that burden of feeling like, oh, I have to be extra good or extra, you know, achieve so much success in order to prove to the world that, oh, look, they didn't need boys. Their girls did it all. When like me just surviving and living every day is enough for that. You know, like, I don't need to be the queen of Sheba to prove that you don't need to have boys. Right. Yeah.
It's like, ए छोरा छोरा छैन अब छोरीहरू मात्रै रहेछ बिचरा है ए छोरी भएर पनि यस्तो गरेछ. I would like to believe that deep down they mean well.
Yeah.
But, right? But the way they say it makes, like, because I come from a family of two daughters as well, me and my sister. Okay. And knowing that the way they say it and the impact that has, no matter how their intention is or what their intentions are, that still has an impact, no matter where you are, right? Nepal mai hos ya, gau mai hos ya, like America, Australia, jata bhaye pani. So I can 100% relate to you on that. Now, Milly, how was the pressure for you when you were growing up in Nepal? Did you feel like you needed to excel in your studies or did you have to prove yourself unconsciously, even with your parents?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, I like, you know, isn't any like Nepali family or, you know, I think that studies and, you know, being, you know, getting good grades and, you know, well, in school is something that's always ingrained in us, I feel like, you know, and there's always that pressure of like, oh yeah, like get good grades, you know, and being in Nepal and, you know, like your parents hit you and your teachers hit you. So it's like, you're like, I have to do well. Like, you know, so there's definitely that pressure. I think that personally, I think the pressure was a lot more when I was in America, actually.
Mm.
I recognize that sacrifice that my parents made, right? Like they left everything. I can't imagine now being like, I'm gonna get married and then I'm just gonna leave my whole family and then go somewhere else that I don't know.
Start from scratch.
Exactly. Start from scratch. Don't do the job that I studied for, right? Just all these changes.
And there's no Google or like all these different social media or internet to help you guide where to go. Like, you know, nowadays we're so privileged. We just look, oh, cafe's near me.
Like, yep. You know. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I'll just look it up. I'm just like, oh, that's okay. I'm like, just send me the address. I'll look it up. Right. And so I definitely think, you know, that is something that I always, I'm so grateful for and know that that's something that the sacrifice that they made. But I think in the alternate side, because it was that big of a sacrifice and it, you know, it turns into this sort of a, you know, really that this big shadow, you know, it was this very big, like we left everything. So now you have to be the best, you know, you have to be your 100%.
We left everything for you, for your future. So you can do better.
Right. And we have to prove that this was all
it was worth it.
Right. Yep. And, you know, and for me, I think, you know, I think in their intentions and in the heart, it's, you know, the idea is that I want my child to be happy and, you know, successful and, you know, have enough, you know, finances and be, you know, be just in general, just be happy and successful. I think for me, I take that on as in, I also want that success and that happiness and that love and that work for my community, but it's going to look different than what maybe they've envisioned. And one that's because the world is not what it was before.
Exactly.
Right. The world career-wise is not what it was before. Mm. People's idea of success is not what it was, right? This idea that we have, you know, especially, you know, in Asia or, you know, in different cultures, very, very strong of like, you have to get married.
A rigid way of thinking what success looks like, right?
Right. It looks like a good job. And then it looks like marriage. And then it looks like two kids. Right.
House.
Right.
Cars.
Cars, kids, house. And for me, I don't feel that's what the success is for me because ultimately, you know, I really think it's a very capitalistic way of thinking of success. Yeah. And I think it's been branded, right? I don't think it's truly what we want. Mm. Especially all the values that Nepali culture, you know, really encourages. Family, community, service, right? But like all those things, but then you're thinking of, okay, make good money, then like just get married and have kids and then have cars and then houses. It's like very, I think it's both of those things are not, don't align well with each other.
Mm. I usually ask this question towards the end of the interview, but I guess we're already talking about it. So I just want to ask you now, Milly, what does success mean to you now?
You know, success to me now, it's really rooted in wanting an opportunity to make a healthier life for me and my community. And that includes, you know, friends, family, and everybody that I'm able to touch. And it also means for me to live my most true and authentic self and in any sphere of my life. And that includes, you know, in my romantic life, in my platonic friendships, in my family relationships, in my professional relationships, is to live authentically. And I think when you live authentically, you are able to do so much good because you are living your truth. And when you do that, you are able to support other people in their truth and accept other people in their truth, whatever that is. So for me, success is not defined by how much money I have in the bank, what high achieving school I'm going to, or, you know, how many cars I have or what house I live in. Because we know that in the end, rich people often feel very lonely and very empty. And we see that there's so much, you know, and right now there's a lot of emphasis on mental health as well. But we see that it's so important that we are feeling loved by ourselves and love within ourselves. So I'm really going for that.
The quality.
Exactly. The quality of my relationships, the quality of my relationship to myself, and how am I giving back to my community, and how can I help uplift this community? And that can look, and I always use that caveat, you know, that can look like I'm going against my community. But if I can't speak out against my own community and can't, you know, try to, you know, kind of eliminate all of these kind of discriminatory and, you know, unjust social values and norms and traditions, then like, how have I helped my community, right? If we're just perpetuating the same kind of violence over and over again.
So you'd like to lead a rich life, not in terms of wealth, but more so in acts of service to yourself and your community, right?
And definitely, and cultivate those, you know, really significant relationships.
And Mili, we touched a little bit upon when you and your family moved to America when you were 9 or 10. What other transitional challenges did you and your twin or your family faced during the move? Because I would imagine a new country, new place, language, and again, the expectations as well, right? How did you deal with those challenges?
This is where I think I was just so grateful to have my sister, and I think any sibling in general, right? It's like, and to share all those experiences, I think it really just helped me that we're the same age and we went through the same experiences together, right? We're going through the same school stuff together. We're going through the same, you know, kind of hormonal changes together, you know, becoming teenagers and going through all that. And being immigrants here and going through that together. And I think that was really helpful because she was able to articulate maybe what I couldn't. She was able to help me cope with things that I couldn't and vice versa for her. And also for our parents, you know. And I always joke with my mom, I would say, like, Emma, like, only twins could handle you and only you could handle them. Like, you know, whenever we get into these like fights, I'm like, listen. She's like, you're ganging up on me. And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, because we are one. Like, we are one. And that's also kind of what helps push a lot of our, I would say it's pushing evolution. I would say we're here to like help our parents evolve in the sense of our thinking, our insight, our, you know, like how the way our mind frame is working.
100%.
So I think in helping with that, kind of like, so in that transition period when we're here and, you know, we're kind of going through this, are we following these American norms and customs? You know, how do we balance, you know, kind of adapting and developing our own sense of ourself, which is going to be a mix of Nepali culture and American culture because we live here. Like exactly. In the moment of time when we're going through, you know, really fast-paced development through our preteen years. So, you know, in kind of constituting those changes in our household, it was really helpful to have my sister. And I think here for my parents, we have a pretty good sized Nepali community here in Sacramento now. And so having like extended family around was really helpful for them, just you know, logistical of the place itself. Then, you know, just transitioning into jobs and for my mom going through her nursing credentials again. All that wrapped up, but we've been really blessed here. I will say that just with family and friends and having good network.
And Mili, you currently work as a public health administrator. I know. How did you get into this field?
Before I started working in my current job, I went to Nepal, and so that's when I really started my work in dignified menstruation.
Right.
So in 2018 is when I graduated from Berkeley, then I moved to Nepal, and that's when I first started working with Radha Baudel, and so which, you know, was another really big pivotal moment in my life and really an enlightenment period. I mean, she's, you know, just this fantastic, just pioneer of this, you know, menstrual activist in Nepal. And, you know, her work and her tenacity and her passion is, and her, you know, knowledge and her wisdom that she really, that I really learned from her and really awoken this idea of dignified menstruation, an idea of that menstruation and menstruators deserve dignity in every week of their life. And that this is something that is being, you know, ignored and, you know, hidden, you know, and so I did that work with her for the Pavlov Foundation for a bit, traveled to Dzumla, stayed there for about a month or two. Then I was working in Kathmandu and then in Chitwan. So I was working in different places, really doing a lot of like research and community kind of organizing and activism. So hosting, you know, like town halls on menstruation and menstrual health and hygiene and dignity. And then connecting research, actually. And the research was actually really fun. It was really about understanding the construction of like Nepali men's, their idea of like the male gender in relation to gender-based violence, like menstrual discrimination and restrictions. And So, and the focus was on Nepali political men, so people, men in politics. And so in Chitwan, I did a lot of interview with a lot of the local politicians. And, you know, it was just so funny for me to, you know, this like 4'11 girls, like walk out with my little backpack and like, you know, walk into these, like walk into these offices. And I was like, oh my God, namaste, like, can I do this interview? And, you know, and just like talking about like menses and talking about, you know, like, what did you know about menses and all these things? And really understanding that the power dynamic between menstruators and non-menstruators is really cultivated through this culture around menstruation. And the culture really says that, you know, menstruators or menses is like impure and dirty and is, you know, less than. And therefore, menstruators then have a less than value in society. And so that invisible kind of construction of power and empower, which we know for menstruators are, they're feeling weak and less than, and they're feeling, and that's how they're cultivating their own self-esteem. And so you really, you know, it's really dark and it's really insidious. We really see how we're building up this this culture around gender-based violence, which really includes that menstrual discrimination and that inability to have dignity, you know, that's just stripped of that dignity during our menses and during our menses cycle, which means all throughout your life, because we're always on the cycle, right, in some part of it.
Exactly. Have you always been passionate about this field and being actively advocating for menstruators, or has this just been a recent in the last few years once you've completed your studies?
Right. I've always been really passionate about sexual and reproductive health. And for me, that and again, that comes from, you know, being a part of this culture, which, you know, I'm not afraid to say is steeped in misogyny and is in patriarchy and violence. And, you know, this inability to access, you know, information around sexual reproductive health and being the inability to access sexual health services, especially in Nepal, but also in different places, or even sexual health in education, is a violation of our human right to bodily literacy. And without bodily literacy, we cannot have bodily autonomy. So if we have no bodily autonomy, how can we have liberation? Right? The idea of gender equity and liberation is intrinsically tied to bodily literacy and autonomy. So I've always really been passionate about sexual health, just because I felt like schools, even in America, do not teach about sexual health. It's like so bad.
And forget what they teach you in Nepal. Like, it's almost non-existent.
Exactly. And, you know, people are, there's just no, you know, this is real. Again, this is that violation of our human right, because we deserve to know about our body. So I've always been really into that. So I've done a lot of work around sexual health and educating and being like a sexual health educator during my college years and working like as an HIV counselor and an HIV clinician. Just doing a lot of work around sexual health, but I never, because we, you know, sexual health is not talked about at all. Sex is used to sell everything, but we've never taught about it. We never have empowerment around it.
Or in a positive way anyways, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's like abstinence, or it's like gonorrhea, chlamydia. Like, you're just going to throw all these things at people, right? Like, and that cultivates that strong rape culture as well, right? It cultivates all of those things. And it's all really, really just so interconnected. But it's so funny. It's like, I did sexual health for so long, and then I graduated, and then I met Radha. And then after I like really like learned about this you know, really silence around menstruation and menstrual health and, you know, dignity, everything just clicked. You know, I learned so much from her every day, because she showed me, you know, she said, how are you talking about sex when you're not talking about menses? Like, how can you even talk about sex without talking about menses? And it was in that moment in time where I was like, oh my God. I was like, wow, like here is the missing piece. You know, we're talking about the consequences. We're talking about rape, sexual assault. We're talking about, you know, unplanned pregnancies. We're talking about all of these consequences, but not the root. And where's the root? And the root lies in that discrimination against menstruation and that inability to have dignity and that and all that violence that is perpetrated. So after I met her and I, you know, really that kind of sparked against in my mind and my heart. I've been doing that work ever since I met her. So it's been about three and a half years now that I've been doing this work around menstruation. Currently, I sit as the director for the Global South Coalition for Dignified Menstruation North America chapter and for the steering committee, which is based in Nepal, but we're in about 8 to 10 different locations around the world, really trying to cultivate a, you know, strong global understanding of dignified menstruation and why it's so necessary and why it really encompasses menstrual health, hygiene, you know, infrastructure, public policy, just everything. Because it's saying that when you prioritize one's dignity, which comes from just the fact that they're alive and they're humans, you are going to be able to give them all those other necessary components. Because if someone doesn't have menstrual products, how can they be dignified? Because they need that. It's a necessity.
Exactly.
If someone doesn't have clean water and infrastructure, toilets, if someone doesn't have education around it, like, you know, all of these components all fit into it. So that's kind of what we're working on right now. And I imagine I will, this is life work for me. You know, I'm not planning on this, you know, it's not a project that I'm picking up. So really after meeting her, this is life work. And in order to, you know, achieve that, you know, reproductive justice and, you know, equity and
even just raising awareness, like that's, it sounds like such a small thing because as women, we go through it. We've been going through it since like our teen years.
Yeah.
But raising awareness around it is so important. And with social media being everywhere and all the negative impact of social media, like this is one good thing about social media, I think. Yeah. Pages like yours, like Dignified Menstruation, talking about menses and how it's okay to talk about it. Like, I remember till last year, whenever I had my periods, I would hide like my pads in my, you know, under my sleeve and like sneakily see if anyone saw me and like go to the bathroom. And it only took me about a year and I'm in my 30s. It only took me like, it was just a year since I like openly say that I'm I'm having my periods and don't care who's listening to me. Like, you know, I'm not shy about, oh, like I've got my periods and say hush, hush. I'm like, I've got my periods. For my cramps, I've got to use the bathroom. Like, you know, so even with all this, like it's taken a while. So I can only imagine what the teens nowadays, when they are like looking up these pages and see like, oh my God, like you're empowering all these young individuals. And that's such an amazing impact to have.
Thank you so much. It's been really beautiful. And seeing people, especially when Nepali girls, you know, or Nepali menstruators in general, when they message me and they, you know, they say like, you know, after listening to this, I sat my family down. I told them that I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to not go in the kitchen anymore. And I'm going to break these barriers. Oh my God. And these restrictions. I just feel so immensely happy. And I just feel like if one person, if one menstruator is feeling more dignified, if one menstruator is changing their, you know, daily activities or changing, you know, or changing the layout of their house or changing the behaviors in their household and inside themselves, and they're feeling like, you know, they really deconstructed that negative and, you know, impure and thoughts about menstruation and menses and themselves when they're menstruating or when they're not menstruating. It is so powerful. And I just like, it's that one, you know, we're working with individuals and we're really, you know, we want this to be something, this movement to, you know, really capture everybody. But we know that this, you know, it's been years and decades of this kind of violence and this, and, you know, menstruators have internalized this so much, right? You know, and I love that you should share your story, you know, at 30 years old, 30 years of this has been, you know, you've been shaped by it. And then in 1 year, you know, you really took that understanding and you were like, we're like, fuck this. Like, this is crazy. Like, this is crazy. Like, this is just me living life as a normal human being. This is a normal part of humans, right? It has nothing to do with anything. I always say it starts with us and it starts with reflecting on what biases we have and being truthful to ourselves. And again, it connects all to that authenticity and living that kind of a life and really looking for dignity in any and everything that you do. And it's hard. And I always say this too, you know, they're like, oh, like, you know, you say like it's so easy. Like, no, I'm not saying it's easy at all.
But you've got to start from somewhere, right? Like if you keep saying it's difficult, we can't do it. It's like
it's slow,
thousands of years of trauma and all these different societal rules, then you're never going to change. Like, you have to start somewhere.
Exactly. And society's not going to change. You know, it's like, you know, it's so funny when we say like, oh, but society doesn't let us, or like, you know, we think we're trying to talk about it in a way that it's this other entity trying to control us. And we make up society. Like, we are society. And maybe it doesn't feel much when it's just you doing it in your household, but then you tell your friend, and then your friend does it in their household.
And it's a movement.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Millie, are you able to use this at your day-to-day work life as well? I think you said you're working in Planned Parenthood.
Yeah. So I work for Planned Parenthood currently as a reproductive health specialist. It's been such an amazing opportunity for me, because I've gone to, you know, work with real patients for this last 2.5 years. So I'm providing, you know, a full spectrum of sexual and reproductive health. So anywhere from pregnancy and preconception to abortion and anything in between, and like testing and, you know, everything in between. So it's been really amazing. And being able to work in the clinic and working with actual patients and, you know, educating them, doing clinical and pharmaceutical counseling, you know, taking their vitals, doing their blood draws, just everything has been so, really just so informative for me. And my work as like a menstrual advocate influences me every single day. I, you know, in the words that I use, you know, I was asked about their menses, you know, and everyone, half people are always so confused. They're like, what is that? And I'm like, your menstrual cycle? And then they're like, my period? I'm like, yes, your menses. And so, you know, it's really nice to be in a position where I'm able to influence folks in that way and be able to really do a lot of destigmatizing counseling. Because I will say a lot of the work that I do is destigmatizing sex, sexual health, menstruation, conditions, gynecological conditions, and, you know, it's just destigmatization of their bodies and validating their bodies and their choices, and showing folks how they can empower themselves is such a big part of this work, and will continue to be that work to work with patients. And for me, I'm always going to stay in sexual health and reproductive health and menstruation. This is really my spear. And so you had asked earlier kind of about what I'm going into now. And so I am going to finish off my my work here in Planned Parenthood. And I just got into medical school, so I'll be attending.
Oh, that is amazing. What an amazing achievement. Like, congratulations, Millie.
Thank you.
That is super, super impressive, because I know in America, getting into med school is not like a straightforward process, right? Like, you have to study pre-med, you've got to get all the experiences, then you've got to sit for MCATs. And like, I just know from hearing from my friends who went to med school, like, that is not an easy thing to study for. Mm-hmm. What was that process like for you? Like, how long did it take? Walk us through it.
It was honestly, it was like, it was awful. The whole process was awful. It's so discriminatory. The process is so discriminatory. It's very classist. It's very classist. So there's just so much money you have to put into it that it's really, you know, they're really gatekeeping this elite status of like providers. And that's that I really experienced, because even, you know, I mean, obviously for me, you know, my parents are not doctors. I don't know any doctors really, personally. So the only kind of understanding I had of it was through school. And I did go to a really good school where, you know, they did have other folks who were going into medicine, but our school actually didn't even really have like a pre-med counselor. So you really had to figure out everything on your own. And I did do that, and it was good. And, you know, I had a lot of friends who helped me, and I wouldn't have been able to go through the process without that, because there's just, the process is so long, and also it's so complicated, and it has all these, it's a trick, really. It's a game, and you have to know how to play the game. And folks who have that kind of resources know how to play the game. But when you don't, there's a lot of mistakes that I made in my application that I didn't even know about. You know, I'm following the rules, and then they say, oh no, don't follow these rules. You should have done this. And I'm like, how would I have known that? And the amount of money that I took to apply to all these schools was insane. And like, it was insane. And then the end result too, you know, you hopefully you're going to get into one school, you know, after like spending thousands of dollars. And then there's folks who apply for a lot of schools and then do not get it at all. It's really a big money-making scheme, honestly. You know, you're paying for the primary app, which happens first. Then you're paying for the secondary app, individually.
Oh, so what's the difference?
So the process goes like this. First, you take your MCAT, which, like, you know, is like an 8-hour course on the computer, because it's only last 3 years, which makes no sense at all. Why? And then after that, you have your primary, which is when you do kind of like there's like two questions. It's like, why do you want to be a doctor? And what have you done, basically? So these two questions you fill out, and these two you send to everybody. So it's like just two generic kind of personal statements. After that, you have these things called secondaries, where schools that are interested in you will send you additional questions.
Right. Okay.
And then you send it back. But the primary cost, you pay for your primary app for every school, and then for every secondary you pay.
Oh my goodness.
And before they used to, like, if you got a secondary, you had a very high chance of getting an interview, because, like, that's how they use the system, right? But now, because you have to pay for your secondary, everybody will send you a secondary.
It's the money-making business.
It's a money-making business. They make millions of dollars.
Wow.
It's insane. So after the secondary is when you have your actual interview, if they do call you back. And so in the actual interview, it depends on what style of interview the school does. But some schools will have interviews that are like traditional interviews, which is just, you know, normal questions like, you know, tell me about a time when you...
Your strengths, right, weaknesses, mm-hmm,
exactly,
that kind of thing.
Just normal interview questions. Then you have things called MMI style. And MMI style is the more like medical school kind of interviews that they have. And it's situation based. For my school right now, there's about 12 different interviewers, and it was like 5 minutes each. And
in one panel.
And so, and it would just keep the scenarios would change, and it's time based. So then I'll be talking, and then they'll just, the interview room will just leave.
That's intense.
So yeah, it was pretty intense. And then they have like ethical questions where they kind of ask you just about like ethics, and, you know, so it was pretty intense. I will say that. For me, I'm going to the school here in Sacramento. Actually, it's UC Davis, so it's like a sister school for Berkeley, but the medical one. And I'm really thankful. I'm so happy that I'm going there, because they're really focusing on transforming medical education. And, you know, all schools are gonna have those goals, but I'm hoping that Davis is doing a lot of work around it to make it happen. And they really value primary care. And for me, I really value primary care. You know, those are the gatekeepers here in America. You have to go to your primary care before you can go to a specialist. I'm hoping to go into like OBGYN, so continue with like the reproductive care and help doing this work.
I feel like that's such a great fit as well. And you coming with your passion about reproductive health, sexual health, and like you said, destigmatizing like all these different things around sexual health.
Yeah. And there are so many providers that still hold that stigma and, you know, have those biases in the work they do. For me, it's not about being a doctor, making lots of money, having a big house, getting married, having my kids, and then like live my life just going to work daily and just doing that work, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to join the rat race of doctors out there that are, you know, that have been taught by the system, right? And that's one of my fears is, you know, going into, not that I'm really scared about it, but I always think like, oh, now that I'm going into this big system, like, am I going to be influenced? Am I going to start thinking differently? And I don't feel that I will, but I always joke about it. I always say like, oh my God, like now I'm going into the system, and it makes me want to hold on to my values even more, and makes me think about them.
And be more conscious about it as well, yes. Isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Be more conscious about it and not get lost in the, you know, it's really easy, especially when I was doing my pre-med, to get lost in all of that and to feel like I need to be the best and I need to do good in school. And if I don't, then I'm worthless, you know? I think that's what we really is ingrained in us. And for me, I think through all these years, I've really come to understand that knowledge and wisdom and all those things and is not connected to your grades, to be honest. It's connected to that's a systemic way of looking at it. But for me, I want to like understand it truly because I want to know that knowledge, and hopefully that comes out in my work. I'm not going to fault myself for the system that I already know is messed up. And then where's the happiness and where's that success that we're gunning for, you know?
Yep, 100%. I feel like you've said everything that I've been wanting to say or ask. And it's just been so liberating to like hear you say all these things and knowing that you are on the path to become a doctor and a doctor who actually cares about these things. I'll be looking forward to your journey, Millie.
Yeah. Oh, no, thank you so much. I am too. And I know that there is a difference in having providers who have this kind of a mindset. And yeah. So I'm happy to be infiltrating that. And that's what I hope to bring to medicine, is not just to simply, you know, weave myself into the fabric of medicine, but to disrupt that pattern, that same pattern that's been going on, to disrupt it. And so maybe we can make some small waves and changes. And so then hopefully it'll you know, accumulate into big tidal waves and tsunamis of changes. And that's what I'm really hoping for.
Now, to wrap things up, Millie, if anyone's lost and trying to find their path or their passion, or have their passion but are somewhat hesitant to move forward, so what would you advise?
You know, first, I think it's so important to grow what feeds you, you know? Like, you should grow what feeds you. So if that passion feeds your soul, if that passion, you know, you're into art, dance, music, whatever, chemicals, chemistry, whatever you're into, grow that. Grow that, because it will feed you and it will feed your soul and it will make you happy. And then when you are happy and when you are, you know, really cultivating that kind of authentic lifestyle, success will happen in that way. And that is success. You know, and for people who are resistant to that pathway, you know, whether it be your parents or your family, friends, whoever, if that is your true passion and that's what you think about all the time, you wake up thinking about, you know, you're in the shower, you're thinking about it. If that's your thing, do that thing, you know, and other people will come around to your happiness too. And if they can't, then it is what it is. It doesn't mean that they won't be back in your journey, but do that thing. Do the thing that wakes you, do the thing that feeds you, because, you know, there's so many folks who are, you know, successful in their career or successful in what they're doing, but that's not their passion or that's not what they want to do. And then you have that emptiness. And I think it's a disgrace to our life. You know, we always wonder, what is the purpose of life? And maybe the purpose of life is to do that thing that feeds you so that you can continue growing in whatever way. And then you know, and when you do the thing that grows you just support your community so much because you want to share that thing, you know, like you love that thing and then you just want to share it. And then other folks can become inspired in that, find pleasure in that, appreciate that. And, you know, just really love on you on that. So whatever the thing it is that you love, grow it.
So beautifully said, and really just emphasizes or brings points to what you are all about as well, Millie, about living that quality life and doing something that really feeds your soul, because when you take care of yourself, you're able to take care of others.
Exactly.
Right? So if you're able to cultivate that passion within yourself, then you'll be able to help the community and find some other external factors that could help you both grow, I guess.
Yeah. And then the community grows, and it's just so beautiful to see people come together and, you know, and how we met, and, you know, like how we, I love meeting other people and meeting and knowing other people's passion and what grows them. And then you can feed into that too, you know, and that's synergy. And that's how just beautiful projects happen and changes happen. And I just, you know, it just feels so when you feel that magic, hold on to that magic. You know, like hold on to that magic, because we always say, like, what are we doing in this world? Like, what is the purpose? And maybe that is the purpose. Find that magic, growing it, living in it, living in that truth. And then, you know, everything else is just BS in between.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time, Millie. I really enjoyed talking to you today. Your passion just comes through to the screen, and it's just got me so excited to see what's next for you. And we are all rooting for you here at Hamro Yatra.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm receiving all the blessings, and I'm just so thankful and appreciative of this time as well. And I've had such a fun time just talking about my journey, and I hope that we can do other projects together. So
I look forward to it too.
Yeah, we do.
As always, if you enjoy these conversations as much as I do, please share with your friends and family. If you'd like to share your feedback, you can reach us on Instagram at hamro.yatra or email askhamroyatra@gmail.com. I love hearing from you, so keep them coming.